Welcome to the Red Sneaker Podcast, your guide to success in the worlds of writing and publishing. Now, here's your host, best-selling author and founder of the Red Sneaker Writers Center, William Bernhardt.
Hello, Red Sneaker Writers. This is episode 27, going out on September 9, 2019. This podcast is for Red Sneaker Writers, people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them do it. Today, for this very special episode of the podcast, we are recording live from WriterCon. Yes! You've got it. You hear that totally unprepped enthusiasm because we are all having a blast here at the conference with more than 50 presenters and all kinds of people doing all kinds of writing. And we're going to talk more about that and what we're doing here at our annual writing conference. We're also going to have interviews with two of my favorite writers in the world, John Woolley and Barry Friedman.
Oh, I like Barry.
And that was Barry, of course. But first, the news. Before we start the news, let me give you a quick word of explanation. Most of this podcast was recorded live at WriterCon, but because we were short on time and because my voice was about to give out, I decided to hold off recording the news segment until a week later when the podcast was actually due. As it turns out, my voice is not one bit better now than it was then, but we do have another week's worth of news to cover, so that part is good. First news item to cover. You remember in a previous podcast, I talked about people's concern and in some cases anger about Audible's announcement that they're going to start adding a captions feature to many audiobooks. That is, at the same time that you're hearing the audiobook, you could conceivably see written captions. Well, many people are not happy about that, and that unhappiness has now evolved into, what else? It's America. A lawsuit. Just about a week ago, seven members of the Association of American Publishers filed a lawsuit against Audible, trying to prevent them from moving on with captions before it's ever begun. According to their petition, the publishers say that this program will be a, quote, quintessential infringement that the Copyright Act directly forbids. They say that it creates a derivative work, and that's a key legal term under the Copyright Act. It's a derivative work being created without compensating the people involved, like the authors. No payment, no permission. They're saying that gives them a competitive advantage over those people who are not willing to violate the law. Well, we'll see what's going to happen with this. Here are a few perspectives or thoughts on this. In response, Audible said, and here's another quote, "Captions was developed because we, like so many leading educators and parents, want to help kids who are not reading engage through more listening." Well, doesn't that sound wonderful and altruistic? I just got to point out, though, that the announced program includes not just children's books. It has a broad range of adult trade titles, books you would never expect kids to be reading. So how exactly is captioning those going to help out kids? You know, it's sort of almost comical as somebody who's been a trial lawyer and represented many corporations to suggest that any new program from a corporation has been created to help this group or that group. Programs get created because somebody thinks they'll be profitable. The point of a corporation is to make money, period. And there are some problems with the whole claim that this does not create a derivative work. I'm not the first person to point out that for several years now, Audible has had something called immersion reading, which is basically a pay-for add-on to Kindle purchases. In other words, you buy the Kindle book, and then for a little bit more, you can also have the audiobook extension. Well, captions is really the same thing in reverse, but since that's been a paid add-on in the past, how can they say that it's not, an add-on, not an additional new work now? You can decide for yourself whether you think captioning creates a derivative work. Is that something they could sell on its own? No. But I suspect that it is something that they should compensate all the people involved for, including authors. I mean, that's only right, correct? I mean, we are authors and we are entitled to be compensated for our work. In the future, I rather suspect that Audible will start adding a contract clause to their contracts, making it clear that they are also acquiring the right to caption works. But what will happen to all the contracts and all the books they contracted for in the past? That's what this lawsuit is really all about. One other key problem, though, any lawyer can tell you that a civil lawsuit is only for one thing. Sure, they're trying to prevent captions from happening, but usually what courts can do is provide money damages. To get damages, you have to show that you've been harmed. Are book sales really going to be depressed because Audible has started adding captions to audiobooks? It's hard to imagine. So establishing damages may be difficult. Someday I hope to be such a big deal writer that people consider an interview with me to be a news item. Hasn't really happened to me, but it has happened to Hugh Howey, who many of you will know is one of the pioneers of the self-publishing movement and one of the first huge success stories to come out of it. He started self-publishing first a novella and then a series of novellas under the name Wool. They're science fiction, longest short stories, basically, and they became incredibly popular, selling at 99 cents. What really put him on the top of the threshold was when Simon & Schuster came calling, offering him a book deal based on his past success, and he granted them what they wanted with respect to print rights, got himself into bookstores, but turned them down as to ebook rights. He was perhaps the first to prominently decline an offer from a major Big Five publisher on ebook rights, saying he thought he could do better with them himself. And as it turned out, he was probably right. Anyway, he's usually on the private side, not much in the public spectrum, but he's just given an interview for a podcast called The Knowledge Project and has some wonderful bits of interest to Red Sneaker writers, anybody functioning in the writing world today. So I urge you to check it out. Here are my two favorite snippets from that interview. First, he talked about writing process, everybody's writing process, and basically making the point that there's not just one way to a successful novel, but to the contrary, everyone's writing process is different. He says, some people can sit down and write once upon a time, and then a whole novel can flow out. Some people have to outline really heavily. And he goes on to say that for himself, he imagines the whole story in his mind and then writes it out, giving more detail than anybody could actually see in a movie. And that's his writing process. You know, at WriterCon, we did a panel. Renee Gutteridge, wonderful woman, wonderful writer, and I did a panel basically on the topic of, you know, pantsers versus planners. Planners, like me, who always outline the book, like I showed you how to do in my book, Creating Character. And then pantsers, that is people who write from the seat of their pants, like Renee, who don't outline, just sit down and write every day, but nonetheless somehow get the book done. In fact, Renee always gets the book done, and she's written some wonderful books. So I think Hugh is right. There is more than one way to get it done, and you have to figure out what's going to work best for you. The only thing I caution people against is saying, well, I'm a pantser, and that's the reason that I'm not writing today, because I don't really feel like it. That will not get books written. Which leads us to the second quotation from Mr. Howey's interview. He says, again, based upon his own experience, he says, quote, if you can just maintain that consistent energy in one direction, it's incredible what you could deflect over a long period of time. And for me, just 1 hour a day of writing, you'll write a novel in a year guaranteed. He's right. Of course, I recommend that people do more than an hour a day. Perhaps you'll get there a little sooner than a year, but what's most important, of course, is the quality of the book. You get the first draft done in a few months, and then you can revise and revise and revise and maintain whatever schedule you've set for yourself. But what is most important is that you write consistently. Keep those juices flowing. Keep your subconscious mind focused on the book. So even when you think you're not working on your book, you kind of are, because your subconscious is working out the puzzles and untying the knots. So when you sit down the next day to write, you are ready and you remember what's going on because you were just working on this yesterday and you can get much more done. Third news story has to do with a Chinese search engine called Sogou, S-O-G-O-U. Here's what they're doing. They're creating artificial intelligent voices to read popular novels. Well, you're thinking, I've heard AI voices before. Some of them sound robotic. Some of the better ones, like Siri and Alexa, sound more realistic. But here's the twist for Sogou. They're going to read popular novels in the author's voices. Apparently, they record a large database of the author's voice saying different words, and then they can recombine that and put in the algorithms and do all the computer magic and end up with an audiobook, natural sounding, in the author's voice, reading an entire book that they've never actually read. Wow! Imagine a 10-hour audiobook recording of Court of Killers, but I didn't have to go into a studio for 6 days and record it over and over and over. I am ready for this AI to happen. This is one time AI is not scaring me. I'm ready. Last news story, which you may find more frightening than that last one, and that has to do with a new app being offered, which is targeted towards writers. It's called The Most Dangerous Typing App. Yes, that is actually the name. And what it is designed to do is help writers fight procrastination. What? Writers procrastinate? Who? Where? Where'd that come from? Well, that's what Hugh Howey was talking about just a second ago. The tendency to find reasons to put things off. Well, not if you're using this app. Because what it is basically a pretty simple text editor with one significant twist. And here I'm quoting straight from the description. If you stop typing before 5 minutes is up, your work starts to fade. And if you don't start again immediately, it disappears completely. End quote. Yes, you heard me right. If you start goofing off or daydreaming and don't type for 5 minutes, your work goes away. The gentle part, I guess, is that it starts to fade before it completely disappears. But, you know, I guess you'll see there if you're still sitting there, not if you're gazing out the window or you got up to fix a sandwich or something, you could come back and find a blank screen. I understand what they're trying to do, keep you focused on your work so that when the pop-up tells you that an email has arrived, instead of looking at it and then getting off on a tangent that takes 15 minutes, instead you say, no, I better stick with my writing. That part is good, but this is way scary and I'm not going to be doing it. But if you think it'll help you stay on target, I can't even recommend it on that level. This is dangerous, guys. Find other ways of staying on track. Just be disciplined and tell yourself, no, I'm writing a book. The email can wait. The dogs don't have to be walked right now. I'm not that hungry, or whatever your excuse is going to be. The laundry can wait. Sit down and write. Write every day if possible. Write as long as you can stand. And like Hugh Howey says, eventually you will have a book. Now, that's the end of the news section of this, but I wanted to, before we plunge into the main interview of this podcast, share with you a few brief, wonderful interviews from some of the people attending WriterCon. Since we're here recording live, and we've got this fabulous brain trust of people attending the conference, I wanted to talk to them a little bit about why they're here and what they're getting out of this writers' conference. Jill Quash, tell us, what brought you to WriterCon?
Well, you did.
More.
Well, I listened to one of your audiobooks, and at the end, you mentioned to email you if we wanted to get the ebook copy. So I did, and you were like, hey, you should come to WriterCon.
Not that I'm prejudiced, but
That worked. Fantastic. So how's the WriterCon experience going so far?
It's amazing. I'm just so excited. I want to do cartwheels, but I can't really do that in the hallway without getting weird looks. But I think
we'd be okay with it. So what are some of the things you're taking away from the conference? And this is Saturday. We're only halfway through it. But what are some of the things you've gotten so far?
I have learned so much. I've learned about pitches and literary agents and what to do, what not to do. I have learned so much, like just how to your first page and the chapter one. I've learned a ton. Another awesome thing is just the networking, like meeting great friends. My husband was like, you should get a mentor. And I was like, I got one already. I got two.
Excellent.
Or three. No, I have a ton. It's like, wow, I have so many options. But just that and meeting friends. And even for my book, I wanted to like interview. I was like wanting to interview somebody that went to the Vietnam War and their spouse. And I met somebody actually that's writing here. So it's just been amazing every day. And I just enjoyed it. And it's not even over yet. So.
Oh, fantastic. Thomas Miller, you've been to small group retreats. You've been to WriterCon before. You are a published author. What are you getting out of this conference?
I came here 4 years ago with a goal to improve my writing, of course, and to network with other people who write and who are in the business. And I have to admit, my expectations were a little low. I thought, well, if I get...
Nothing personal, right?
No. Okay. Nothing personal, but I've been to other writing conferences where I sat there for 3 days. At the end of it, asked myself what I got out of it, and I said, well, the food wasn't bad. So I really did come into this not sure if I would come back the next year. Well, I came back the next year, the year after that, and... I'm finding that there's a lot more than just the classes and the speakers. There's a certain zeitgeist, a certain underlying current and theme of being able to connect with other writers, no matter what their genre, no matter whether they're fiction or nonfiction, what they hope to achieve and how we can support each other. And I know a lot of people think that writing somehow is competitive, and maybe it is in a bookstore bookshelf. But when it comes to this conference, everybody is here to support everybody else.
No, I think writers are some of the most generous people on earth. Sitting next to you is Stormy Maynard, who's also been to retreats and also been to WriterCon before. What keeps you coming back, Stormy?
The people involved. You bring quality people in, and usually it's a question of having to decide between two or three or even all four presenters in a certain time slot, trying to figure out which one is going to be the one that means the most to you, trying to get them all in.
Right. You guys are clearly part of the Red Sneaker family at this point. You've been several times over. Let's get Melissa in. Scoot that. This might be noisy, everyone, but we're going to bring in Melissa Kingsbury. Tell me a little bit about your WriterCon experience.
My WriterCon experience, I was turned on to this conference by my friend Flea, and she and I were in a writing group together in the 90s, and she remembered some of my writing, and I had some publishing in a Tulsa Kids. And then I just stopped. I stopped because life happened, and when I met with her again, a couple weeks ago, she says, you know, you really ought to go because
I like this friend.
I can tell that you miss it. And I never stopped writing. I just stopped networking, you know. So I lost all my writer's inspiration, kind of. So being here, and I'm a memoir writer, being here, I've learned that I need to be truthful and I need to be true to my own voice. So, also, I've learned that there's a lot of information coming at me like a fire hose.
Right. Oh, there's a lot to know.
The best advice I've had so far is after each day, write down one or two things that you think you can implement when you go home. Otherwise, you're going to be overwhelmed. So, I have done that so far. And I already know a couple of things I'm going to be doing as soon as I go home. So
I think that's terrific advice. I mean, we are living in a world where the publishing environment seems to change about every 10 seconds. It's impossible to keep up, or very difficult to keep up, for me anyway, with everything that's going on. But you get all these people together and start talking and swapping, and like we did at the roundtable yesterday, exchanging ideas, and that can be even as beneficial as the classes, I think, sometimes. Of course, I may be prejudiced, but I think one of the best benefits is that my wife, Laura, is here, and you got to hear her sing, right? You wouldn't feel put upon if I asked you to sing, would you, Laura?
It depends on what you ask for.
What are you getting out of WriterCon?
All these beautiful people. Everything that they just summed up so eloquently are the same things that I'm getting out of this too. I completely understand what you're saying, but being overwhelmed by all the information coming in, you have trouble picking which one do I go to. They're all so good. Bill does a fabulous job of bringing in terrific people to the point that you could go to any session and learn something. That's fabulous. But for me, really, it's a chance to connect, network, get to see people that I do not get to see nearly often enough. We sit at our desks, at our computers, and we work so hard, often in a somewhat isolated environment, even with our families and whatever. When we're working on our writing, we're often by ourselves. And this gives us the opportunity to get together and brainstorm and share ideas and connect and just talk with people who completely commiserate and understand and are, every one of them, lovely people. I haven't met a single person here that I haven't just loved, and I just know I want to stay in touch with everybody. And fabulous support right here. I'm looking forward to it. I hope everyone comes again every year so we can keep right on.
So there you've got it, Red Sneaker Writers. We may be prejudiced, but we think this is a terrific conference and hope you will come out next year. All right?
My main interview for this podcast is with two of my best friends and favorite writers in the world, John Woolley and Barry Friedman. John Woolley is a true professional writer who has done just about every kind of writing there is to do. He is probably best known in the horror realm, going way, way back about, I think, 40 years to his first novel, Old Fears. More recently, he's writing a trilogy, a huge, wonderful, old-school, Lovecraftian-style horror novel, epistolary novel, yet horror. The series is called The Cleansing. The first book in this series is out. It's called Seventh Sense. The next book will be out soon. It's called Satan's Swine. Barry Friedman is perhaps best known as his stand-up comedian, which he has been doing successfully all around the country and some places outside the borders for decades. But he is also a wonderful writer, author of Road Comic, funniest book you're ever going to read in your life about his experiences as a road comic, and a collection of humorous pieces called Funny You Should Mention It. He has a new book coming out too, a memoir called 4 Days and a Year Later. Wonderful, beautiful book. So I like both these guys, and I knew they'd both be great interview subjects, but I had no idea what would happen when I got the two of them together. Check it out.
Our interview section today, I'm talking to two of my best friends and favorite writers, and that's John Woolley and Barry Friedman. John is the consummate professional writer, having written just about everything there is to write, including some highly successful horror novels. Barry Friedman is a professional.
He's not the consummate professional.
What?
He's not the consummate professional.
It's a totally
professional.
Different thing. Yeah. Yeah. He's, as you might have gotten a hint, professional stand-up comic, but also a writer. They're both extremely talented writers, and both have new books coming out this year. So we'll talk about that and a lot of other things. But first, Barry, the key question for this podcast: if you had one piece of advice to offer somebody who aspires to write, what would it be?
Okay, let me first say it's not cold at all in here.
That's to keep you awake.
Yes. Let me just say, when I was doing stand-up comedy there, the two greatest pieces of advice I ever got, which also works for writing as well. First piece of advice was, tell some truth. And the second piece of advice was, don't suck. And the reason Don't Suck is so good is it's not just what it sounds like. What it always meant to me was, don't assume that just because you're doing it, it has any value without putting some work into it. So the Don't Suck was actually to test yourself and to challenge yourself. So tell some truth and don't suck. That's
so
my
you,
advice.
So you got the first one right.
I'm not the consummate professional that you are.
That's you're certainly not. I'm
all sorts of genres and everything else.
That's right.
Yeah.
Sound advice. John, is there any kind of writing that you have not done?
No. I honestly don't think so.
But I think you're perhaps most associated with the horror genre, having written Old Fears all those years ago, which has been optioned, what, like 47 times
now
or
something? Yeah, just got optioned again by Sony Pictures, yeah.
And other books as well. Mm-hmm. But you've written everything.
I write a lot of nonfiction.
Memoirs and bios, and you've written a book about, what's the deal? Can you just not pick a genre?
No. I'm a jack of all trades, master of none. You know, I mean, no, I just like to try everything. And sometimes, you know, because I was with the Tulsa World for so long as an entertainment writer, I'd learned how to make a great newspaper thing, and those people who've been with a newspaper know this. When you're a newspaper feature writer, you learn how to make anyone sound interesting. And that is one of the greatest abilities that a person can have. And so that makes it logical for me to write a lot of nonfiction as well.
Well, I would think that was something like how people always tell you, you got to have a great hook on the first page. You got to grab them from the beginning. And that's really the same thing you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, with a newspaper, it's always you hook them with the first line. You've got to have a strong first line. You've got to have a strong lead, as they say in the business. You have a strong lead, then you got it. And it's the same thing as a book. A book is just longer, you know? Yeah.
Is there any kind of writing that you find harder than others?
No, not at all. I do find this, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm going to anyway. I have tended to find that the more fun you're having, the less money you're going to make.
But is that okay? Because you're making more fun, having more fun.
Yeah, if you can balance fun and money, right. Which is what I've tried to do my whole career, which is going into its fifth decade now as a professional writer.
Do you think that's why so often you hear writers say, well, my favorite book is... And then it's the title that didn't sell.
Exactly. Exactly. Or the thing that most writers say, remember Ken Jackson, mine and Barry's friend, people would ask Ken Jackson, the consummate newspaper guy, cigarette dangling, slamming phones down. And that's actually how Barry and I met, was through Ken. But Ken would always say, when someone asked him what his favorite book was, he would always say, my next one.
That's good. Barry?
Well, I was just going to say, listen to John's comment about being in the business 4 decades.
That's correct.
I would have thought you'd be better by now.
You'd think.
Just by the third decade, I think you'd be able to get there.
Either that or do something else, right?
In comedy, the parallel is that, and it's often been said, and you don't think it's true while it's happening, is that it takes you 10 years to figure out who you are on stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe as a writer, it takes you a while to figure out what it is you are doing and or supposed to do. And my favorite line about this was in a play called The Sign in Cindy Brewstein's Window, Moraine Hansberg, who wrote Raisin of the Sun. Characters are talking about Greek mythology, and one of the characters says, I thought you liked simple people with simple problems in literature. And she answers, and this is, I guess, why I tend more towards nonfiction. She said, sure, isn't life enough? Mm-hmm. And I thought that really is what it is. And when we figure life out, then we can do fiction. But until we figure out life, there's just too much to cover with just the everyday and the narrative. And I guess that's where John and I actually do well together when we've collaborated together, is we come at it from a little bit different angle.
But we're coming at the same sorts of ideas. And if I can go now lowbrow with you, there was a writer named Michael Avalone, who you know was the consummate paperback writer. He novelized screenplays, he novelized TV. He got 3 cents, I believe he told me it was 3 cents a copy on the Partridge Family books he wrote for Scholastic. Wow. And out of those, he made $30,000. Now, that's a lot of books.
Which was money then.
Yeah, yeah, that was a lot of books still, you know. But he always said, and he had a gift for hyperbole, Michael did, but he said, a professional writer ought to be able to write anything from the Bible to a seed catalog. Mm. And I like that.
And
I like
good.
That.
Yeah. Let's talk. I don't think I've ever had anybody on the podcast who's collaborated. How does that work?
Well, we're going to be doing, as a matter of fact, we're going to be doing a presentation on that tomorrow morning.
Right.
We did two shows together, two or three shows.
I think two, yeah.
Where John's essays, my essays, right?
Yeah.
Your short stories, my short stories. And we put them together for an hour or two presentation. One was at the Performing Arts Center in Tulsa. The other was at the Woody Guthrie Center.
Mm-hmm.
Center. Mm-hmm. And it was like an hour or two of just alternating back and forth. Mm-hmm. And the show, which was directed by our good friend, Vern Stefanik, just was our view of the world. We didn't write anything together.
No, but we did, if I remember on the second one, we read one of each other's pieces.
That's right. And, yeah. and the point was, when you collaborate, we both agreed on this, rare that we agreed on anything,
yeah, exactly.
is that you write with people like you play tennis with people who are better than you. Mm-hmm. And I think John is a far better writer than I am. And he thinks I'm...
And I think I think I'm a far better writer than you are too. But thank you for noticing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you challenge each other because you want the other person to at least give you a little bit of nod in your direction of your talent, which John has not done yet. 15 years, 30 years I've known him. But it is an amazing thing when you collaborate and it works because you stay in each other's lane, terrible cliche, in your own lane. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you see the other person has a view and an outlook on life, which does help you in your own writing.
And Barry's a brilliant writer, honestly. And both of us write for different publications in Tulsa. I write for Oklahoma Magazine. He writes for The Voice. Barry tends to be political and brilliantly so, I think. And I tend to be more, I don't know, lightweight, I suppose would be the
well,
term.
Lighthearted, perhaps.
Lighthearted and lightweight.
Yeah. You know, the line I always loved John gave me was the scratch a cynic, you find a romantic.
Exactly.
Which was my favorite line. But also, you scratch John, you find Oklahoma. There's no one who quite actually captures the spirit of Oklahoma, certainly musically.
Well, and I've done it. That's a lot of the nonfiction I've been able to write. And I was blessed to be with the Tulsa World during the last great days of the newspaper business and write about Oklahoma music and Oklahoma movies. Of course, I came in right to the job right after Coppola.
Book.
Yeah, thank you. After Coppola had come in and done The Outsiders and Rumblefish, and all of this happened. And so I was able to write that book, Shot in Oklahoma, which did really well for me. And as well as From the Blue Devils to Red Dirt, which was one of the centennial books that you published through your publishing
house. And one of the things John also mentioned was that when you talk about narrative and you talk about revealing characterization or characters, John's point was that's why God invented quotation marks.
Exactly.
Just let people talk and hold the record button down.
Uh-huh. Exactly. They said, well, what do you do? What do you do when somebody's just awful? One of the people is just awful that you interview said, that's why God made quotation marks.
Get out of the way. Just tell them what they said.
Yeah. Now, you touched on something when you were talking about the fading influence of newspapers. Mm-hmm. The world is changing, mm-hmm. and nowhere so much so as in the book world, as well you both know. How are you dealing with that, John?
Not as well as I'd like to.
Since you are a self-professed Luddite,
I'm a Luddite.
Turn that question to you.
Well, luckily I have some young boys helping me.
Everyone should have children.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, I have one of my younger son and one of his friends. I have a social media advisor. My younger son and both of my sons are involved in a board game business, Team Covenant in Tulsa, and it's a worldwide board game business. And they have been explaining to me how you brand yourself online and how you build your image.
Right. And all that brand.
It's like I don't have a clue.
Can we just illuminate the problem here? You haven't set up the voicemail on your cell phone yet. When you call,
it says
it is not set up yet.
That's right.
I sent you a text.
You did? You sent me a text?
Yeah, that was
well, you know, that's out in the ether somewhere. Yeah, right. They probably got that on Pluto right about now because I sure didn't get it.
Barry, how about you? How are you dealing? Are you tech savvy?
A little bit more than John, which is, you know, this plant is more tech savvy than John is. I blog more. I do use social media more than John does.
Right.
A lot of the blog is political. But also I use it to tell some of the nonfiction stories about my father and my family. And one of the great things about blogging is you actually see yourself published every day. The bad thing about blogging is you see yourself published every day. Nothing gets thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great to have your stuff out there, and it does get noticed. I mean, I do know that, for instance, when I link one of my columns in Tulsa Voice online, more people read it because it's online than the publication. Mm-hmm. That's just reality. So you can fight that all you want. It's like fighting a telephone now, which, of course, you're still fighting.
I am.
That's just, you know, the content and the motivation and the sitting in front of the computer, that stays the same. But nobody's going to find you. The good news is you can now help people find you.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Between social media and whatever else, you can get your stuff out there.
You know, I have a fan page.
Yeah, there's like six people on it, though.
There are over 1,000, I want
to. Is there really?
Know. Yes. They but set that
over. One of your boys is in charge of that?
Oh, Lord, yes.
But, of course, you can't go and access it because you don't know how to do that. Someone told you about a fan page. And you
I can look at it.
Okay, but you don't know what to do once you see it.
No, I send the blogs out, and somehow they get put on there.
They actually write them on the screen. You know, actually, people just...
It's like Winky Dink. It's like the old TV series. Yeah, and you have a crayon.
And it's like, yeah. It just goes pick up the screen and just shake it, and you write another one.
Barry, I bet some people out there are wondering. I mean, you have a very successful stand-up comedy career. Why write?
Because they're really related. I mean, your best comedians are the ones. If you ever go online, if you ever look at Facebook posts of comedians, whether you know their names or not, and you look at how they post, without seeing a stitch of their comedy, you'll know whether they're good or not. Whether they can put words together, whether they can actually keep a thought moving for an entire paragraph. And the best jokes, Seinfeld was one of the best comedians ever because he's one of the best writers. The jokes have a beginning, a middle, and end. They're edited to the point where there's nothing. You've heard people tell jokes.
Mm-hmm.
The good joke tellers don't waste your time getting to the punchline.
Right.
That's why the greatest joke ever written is still the first joke ever written. I went to the doctor. I said, Doc, it hurts when I do that. He goes, don't do that. Mm-hmm. Not a wasted word in that joke. And that's what I like about the comedy, which is what I liked about writing, is that the two just communicate a point to get you from point A to point B to point C. And then the other parallel is, in comedy, you have to make people you don't know laugh for an hour.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when you write, you have to write for people who do not know you, do not care about you, and you cannot explain to them what it is you really meant in this piece of work. And when you're doing comedy, either they get it or they don't. And you can go back and explain it to them, but at that point, you've lost the show.
Mm-hmm. And the writing has to speak for itself,
too.
And I was surprised earlier you said the word is it takes 10 years to find out who you are on the stage, because I've watched The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and I thought it took about 8 episodes. But that's probably a lot like the writer trying to find his voice, which I think is, I know is important. I spent 10 years scribbling stuff and sending it out, wasn't getting published. And there's a reason. It was horrible. It was only when I started coming a little closer to home and writing those Ben Kincaid books that something clicked a little bit. Is that kind of like what you're
it's
talking
exactly
about?
Exactly what it is. Sometimes you get lucky and you take a guy like Cat Stevens who wrote T for the Tillerman at age 21, right?
Yeah.
No wonder you go crazy after that.
Right.
You start calling for writers' deaths and stuff. Because, you know, you do – most people – have to develop this craft where eventually they get to a point where someone will appreciate the craft. The problem with writers is that you can wake up tomorrow and call yourself a writer. I don't know what that means. You can't wake up tomorrow and call yourself a toll take operator. You have to go through a certain amount of training and certification before they put you to take quarters from people. Well, writers, anybody can be a writer. And you know and I know there is nothing more frustrating than writers who don't write.
Right.
You can teach writers, I guess, to improve on this and improve on that. But there's nothing more frustrating at the Writers Conference is when you have to try to convince people to be motivated to write. Mm-hmm. I mean, that should come with the territory.
Well, and like in any field, probably, practice is so important. The more you do, the better you're going to get. One of the highlights of the retreats is some of the people at this table know you're pretty much compelled to write every day, and it starts to develop into a habit. John, any advice for writers trying to find their voice or trying to find their place in the writing universe?
Well, I think they have to work through their influences first. You know, the very first book I wrote, I got out of the service and went to graduate school at what was then Central State University and studied under Marilyn Harris. And our thesis for my master's degree was a novel. And I wrote a novel called Demon Wind, and it was essentially
Were you laughing?
No, we don't laugh.
Okay, good.
I thought I was having a stroke, actually.
Right. Okay. Well, as long as you weren't laughing,
you
just
may
go ahead.
Slow down
your
it's going presentation. Ahead. It's going to take a while.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. You can excuse yourself.
Went to college? Jeez.
And then,
get me out of here by four.
Yeah, chapter one, I am born.
First decade, four to go.
Yeah, and then Hitler's troops were marching across Germany when my father was.
And I said, no more!
That's right. No, so I
have lost control of the podcast.
So Demon Wind is about a monster in Oklahoma that comes to life during tornado alerts, which I thought was a great idea, but it ends up being H.P. Lovecraft meets Raymond Chandler in Oklahoma, and it was horrible. It's horrible. It's over in, I shouldn't even say this, it's over on the fourth floor of this, what, UCO now, I guess it is.
Right.
As in the theater, and I really hope there is a covering of dust on it, because it's just horrible. But I had to ride through that, right, to get to your own voice. What you do, you have to ride through your influences to get to your own voice. But you have to do a lot, but that means you have to write. Nobody's early stuff is all. I mean, you know, maybe Cat Stevens, the contrary, but nobody's really early stuff is all.
Few
people's stuff is. But I will tell you one piece of advice that I learned. We sold our first book. Ron Wolf and I wrote the first book, the first horror novel we wrote. Was called Oh Fierce, the one we were talking about. Got optioned three times now. And for my
you keep throwing that in because I have nothing optioned. You know that. I know what you're doing.
I'm trying not to look at you when I say because I want to make you feel bad.
Hey, was that optioned, by the way?
It was optioned.
Really?
And it's under option right now. How about yours?
Tell us.
So,
did Sony option this?
Sony Pictures.
Sony Pictures
option. Yeah. So, I did make money and the check cleared. So it took. I thought we were on our way. It was a bidding war in New York. Franklin Watts won it over. I believe it was Random House. And we went with the wrong one on that. But anyhow, and so I thought, man, we are on our way. This was 1982. We didn't sell another book till 1989. Two books that never sold in between there. And I remember I was having one of those dark nights of the soul about 3 a.m. And all of a sudden the equation hit me. And the equation is what I always try and tell people. You wear them down or they wear you down. It's just that simple. And I think that's what every writer ought to know, because we all get disappointed. It's harder. I don't know why people who are the most constitutionally unable to take criticism are the ones that get into this, where you take criticism all of the time. But we do. And you just have to remember, they will not wear you down. You got to wear them down.
That's a great story. Parting advice from either of you?
Very uplifting, John.
Thank you very much.
Bill, you got razor blades for everybody here, too? My God, John.
Somebody give me an upbeat note.
Say something nice, would you? Write well. Write good. How's that?
Which one do you want to use? Do you want to use the adjective or the adverb, Barry? You're a writer, right? I just think I think Barry is right. I used to know everything there was to know about writing. And now I know those two things. I know that you wear them down or they wear you down. And I know that you have to write every day. We've talked about this. You can take a weekend off, but go to the same place every day at the same time and do what you can. And I think that's what you have to do.
Let me just, one caveat to that is look at your output, right? If you're Bob Dylan and you wrote Mr. Tambourine Man on a Monday afternoon, you can take the rest of the week off, right? On the other hand, if you've written for 10 years and your novel is 89 pages, at that point, whatever method you use is not working.
Right.
So if the light from God actually does help you write and your output shows it, then write that way. You don't have to sit down every day from 9 to 3 or whatever. But if that doesn't work for you, then treat it like a job where you go to every day and actually perform the job.
And there you have it, live from WriterCon. Thank you, Barry Friedman and John Wully.
Oh my gosh, wasn't that interview awesome? That was just fantastic. I think I'm going to make that a WriterCon annual event, interview John and Barry. I've never had as much fun in my entire life. WriterCon was a great event. I think this is the best one we've done yet. It gets a little bigger and a little better every year. Everybody felt like they gained from it what they needed to have to take their career to the next level. And that's what WriterCon is all about. But even better, we had some fun along the way. So if you weren't there, I'm sorry. Plan on it next year. We'll be back 2020 Labor Day weekend. In the meantime, of course, there are other programs. We've got the small group writing retreats, a couple of them next year. And next year in February, for the first time ever, the first WriterCon cruise, 7 days in the Caribbean. Yes, talking about writing, but possibly also squeezing in some time on the beach. I'll talk more about that next time, but if you're curious, visit my website, williambernhardt.com. Until next time, remember, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit.